Welcome to the Evident Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evident Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next hour on this July the 15th on the West Coast, now July the 16th on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone. I'd like to welcome those listening in on Wind Talkers Radio Network tonight, and we have one of those special end-of-the-week shows where my co-host Jim Murray joins us, and we get into all kinds of discussions about consciousness and technology, power production, the universe, and in a very meaningful way. And we're going to do that shortly, but before we do, just to get us in the mood, a little bit of Killer Joe. the late Jorge Dalto from Brazil and his rendition of Killer Joe. So that takes us into South America, and we're going to go actually with tonight's guest all the way to the tip of South America and talk about some old science and an old expedition that occurred. Tonight's guest is my weekly co-host on Friday nights, scientist, inventor, author, lecturer, and teacher, my good friend, Mr. Jim Murray. Jim, welcome to the show.
Hey, Don. Thank you. Good to be with you again, as usual. How are you tonight?
Oh, I'm good. I thought it'd be nice to listen to some a little bit of tropical music tonight, you know? Jazz with a tropical flavor to get us in the mood to go down to Antarctica and talk about some strange...
It's been so hot here that I wouldn't mind being in Antarctica.
Yes, I know. Yeah, it's been hot all over the place. We don't have global warming, but it's been hot, you know. So,
well, one of the things I've considered regarding that issue is the lack of circulation that now does not occur in the Gulf of Mexico, because that water swirling through the Gulf used to take a lot of that heat out of this area. Mm-hmm. And away from us over into Europe and up the east coast of the U.S. and all of that good stuff. And, of course, that's not happening anymore. So,
Yeah, that's true. It's like that where I live. The air is stagnant. There's barely any wind at all. Only time you get any wind is if a thunderstorm approaches. And they seem to be manufactured. Any thought on that?
Well, let's put it this way. The things they're manufacturing nowadays are not beneficial for the majority of the people involved. I would prefer that they concentrate on bringing back some jobs, shipbuilding, you know, heavy-duty industry and all that kind of stuff, because that's what this nation really needs. But we've covered that issue a million times, and it doesn't seem to lead anywhere. We're better off talking about Antarctica.
Yeah. Well, there's been a lot of myth about Antarctica. We've had several spooky movies been made about the area. A long time ago, the movie The Thing, do you remember that?
Yeah, I remember that. Actually, I liked the very first one, but I didn't like the John Carpenter version.
Yeah, the first one was more believable.
Yeah, and it was actually more consistent. You know, the thing about the John Carpenter one was that the alien took on whatever shape it felt like, and for some reason it just didn't work for me.
Yeah.
But James Arness played the first vegetable guy, and I thought he did a good job, all things considered. It was a pretty cool movie. As a matter of fact, yeah. I got a copy of it right here.
The Thing sort of sounded like an elephant on steroids, you know, but back when that movie came out, I don't know that we knew what steroids were, but, you know, reflecting back, it's like an elephant on steroids, real crazy sounds.
Yeah, I remember it. It was very interesting. You know what was funny about all those movies? I think one of the reasons why they meant so much to me was because I wasn't allowed to watch them. They were on too late. And my dad had a chauffeur by the name of George Pauper, and he was interested in the same stuff that I was, and he was kind of like a second dad to me. And he used to watch all that stuff and then tell me the stories. And I was dying to see all those movies, but I had already heard a description, you know, from beginning to end on most of them, by George at the time that I was finally able to see the movie. You know, so I already knew the whole plot.
Mm-hmm.
The one that seemed to really enthuse him the most was the what the heck was the name of it? I can't remember the name of it now, but it's the one where the pods keep opening up with something about the body snatchers. The pods keep opening up, and they grow artificial people that are copies of.
That's the invasion of the body snatchers.
Yeah, that was it.
Oh.
Well, we have a lot of invasions. It's just that they don't seem to be popularized.
Well, we have that now, but it's called government. You know?
Yeah.
Well,
there's body snatchers involved also.
Yes. When we talk about Admiral Byrd having been sent down there, who was it? Hoover sent him there? President Hoover? And
I think it was.
Yeah, he was to go down there and find out what the heck was going on. And they speak about inner Earth, but I think what's been covered up is the fact that there was an off-planet presence down there, that someone from another part of the galaxy had actually embedded themselves in underneath the ice there, and that there was sort of a Shangri-La type of atmosphere around that area, similar to the one that Tuesday Lobsang Rampa described in Tibet when he saw the Yeti. He spoke about a Shangri-La where he would come out of the snow-capped mountains and be in this tropical environment, which was similar to something described in Antarctica. So have at it, Jim.
I'm familiar with that, and it's an interesting thing. But actually, the story starts in the Arctic, and that's the part that's so weird, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Colonel Byrd wanted to fly to the pole originally, and I don't know that the original intention of the mission was disclosed. But the funny thing was, according to his log, they were flying very low, and it was reasonably good weather. And they were flying very low, and you know, right around 1,000 feet or so. And when their instruments told them that they were at the North Pole, he continued on the same heading, as if he was still going north.
Mm-hmm.
And according to him, what happened was that within a 2-hour period of persisting on that course, he came to an area that was free of ice and snow. And as you know, the North Pole was primarily an ice pack floating on the Arctic Sea. There was nothing under it.
Mm-hmm.
So for him to talk about coming to a land that was free of ice and snow, he saw forests and identified elephant-like animals grazing, which makes it sound like we're talking mammoths, you know.
Yeah.
And the only reason he turned around was because he had reached the halfway mark on his fuel. But he came back and filed some kind of a report that basically said that he felt he had flown into the interior of the Earth. And if that hadn't happened, then his secondary guess was that the planet is not shaped anything like we think it is, and that there's some kind of a huge semi-tropical dimple that exists at the area where we think the North Pole is. And he came up with a really interesting explanation for it, because other people tried to fly to the pole from other directions, and according to what his report said, they all wound up in different areas. And so he plotted all of the supposed locations of the North Pole, And interestingly enough, it turned out to make a circle about 1,500 miles in diameter. And so he came to the conclusion that there are many different North Poles if you approach it magnetically. If you approach it from the gyroscopic situation, there's only one, but it exists in open space because it's at the center of this 1,500-mile circle.
Mm-hmm.
And so then what I understood from having read all this, and by the way, it was published in a book by a guy by the name of Gardner, I think it was, called The Mystery of the Hollow Earth. And it was back in the 60s when I read it, but it was already printed, you know, a long time before that. And then, so he wanted to find out if something similar existed at the South Pole, and organized an expedition to do the same thing down there. And that's when he discovered this situation down there where there's literally miles and miles of open ice-free water and lush grass growing on hills and, you know, no ice or anything in the immediate vicinity, but it is ringed with ice. Now, whether he reported a, you know, an actual opening into an interior like he did in the first case or not was not really made clear. But there was another story, which was really interesting, about a fisherman from Norway by the name of Ulf Jensen, who back in the 1800s went on a fishing expedition with his son. And they went north from Spitzenberg, or one of those places, or around there, and theoretically sailed over the crest of that 1,500-mile circumference into the inner Earth. And the reason that they knew they were in there was because they could see two suns. As a matter of fact, the name of the book was called The Smoky God, and it was it was describing a situation that you can see a sun in front of you and a sun in back of you, and the sun behind you is the sun we know, and the other sun is this much less intense, kind of a smoky red phenomenon, which apparently supplies light and heat to the inner world. And anyway, they sailed into this thing. And it took them a whole year or two to go through the whole thing, and they have all these encounters with various beings that live in the inside of the planet and what have you. And the son gets killed somehow. I forget what happened to him. And Ulf Jensen emerges at the South Pole, and he's picked up by a Patagonian Navy vessel or something. And before he dies, he relates this whole story to somebody on that ship who, you know. Now, whether there's anything to it or not, who knows, but it certainly makes for an interesting tale.
Mm-hmm. Now, if I can comment a little bit on something, and I know you're relating the story as it's been told. I've had a couple of guests on the show in years past who attested to the fact that they had been taken into the inner earth. And although the way they went was under Mount Shasta, there was a secret entrance there. I was also told that the inner earth people were going to be digging their way out. So there is not an opening in the top, or let's say on the North Pole, looking at it as if that was the uppermost part of the planet, and, you know, like we reference it when we're looking at maps and what have you, and or globes. Anyway, the pilots of today that have flown over that area say that there's no hole, there's nothing that could be seen. Now, isn't it possible that there is definitely an energy vortex there that is multidimensional? And that one could actually go into that portal thinking that they were going into the Earth itself and actually just going into a slightly different dimension. That wouldn't be so absurd. In fact, that's how they move around through space.
Well, yeah, I can see how that might happen, but what are the chances of flying back out from it then?
Well, I mean, once you're in the vortex, you're in the vortex. You're not inside the Earth, so your perception could be a parallel reality.
Yeah, but what I mean is if you are flying in there far enough to see this other dimension that Admiral Byrd reported,
mm-hmm.
You know, can you turn your plane around and fly back out, or do you wind up being a person?
Well, he did come back and relate the story, so I would suppose, yeah, you could enter the vortex and you could leave it. I don't know how adept he was at that or if that's actually what occurred, but to me, it makes more sense on the basis of what other scientific evidence says. Like, we have all these things that, you know, we have secret places on Earth, including the Mayan calendar, that have some kind of special magic that we get dumb and we don't understand what's going on. You know, there's this calendar and it's got a different days and, you know, it's read differently, but man, you got to watch out for it because in another year and a half, it's a mean calendar. I mean, you get the picture of what I'm saying.
Did you know that, can you hear me, Don?
Yes, yes.
I had gone into that other portal just for a moment. I lost the signal, and luckily they got me back on. So I really missed most of what you said. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. I was talking about the fact that there could be this other dimension. Okay, and that the experience of seeing all these other things is merely because you're seeing what that dimension has to offer. It's not necessarily that you're still in a three-dimensional realm. Now, there were people in the area called the Bermuda Triangle that had similar types of experiences. I think they were more related to the underwater bases or underground bases than anything. That really explains a lot of all the myths that surrounded places like the Bermuda Triangle. But when you get into these anomalies of the North Pole and the South Pole, you're more likely to have a vortex there as well. So that's what I was talking about.
I see. Well, the interesting thing is that in that book by Gardner that I was telling you about, they show telescopic views of several other planets. One of them is Mars. I think the other one wasn't Jupiter. It might have been Uranus or one of those. But anyway, they show what looks like a specific opening at the polar regions of that planet, and the guy advances the theory that a vortex may have formed the whole planet in the first place, in which case it shouldn't be solid. It should be hollow because the material would be deposited, you know, in accordance with the form of the vortex,
mm-hmm.
which I kind of thought was interesting. But getting back to the thrust of what we were exploring, I think that there was a lot more interest in the South Pole phenomenon, whatever it may have been, than there was at the North Pole. And I just read an article today, quite honestly. It's so long. I mean, it's got to be a book. But I read the prelude to the thing, and it talks about the fact that this region, which is completely ice-free, and it's at least, it's somewhere between 450 and 1,000 miles square, and it's totally ice-free in the middle of Antarctica, and it's got rolling hills, and it looks very pastoral, and there's all these other interesting things, ice-free lakes and what have you. And apparently there's been quite a secret movement by a number of governments to explore this region for whatever purpose they may have. And information has been leaking out about it for quite a while now. So this fellow who wrote this article, and it's really a book because it's like 390 pages. I couldn't even print it out. It was so long. He talks about the fact that there was an enormous amount of interest in this area by the Germans before World War II. And he builds up this entire history of all of this business that went on. And he gets into all of it. He gets into the special submarines that were designed to, you know, to go to South America and beyond. He gets into the so-called anti-gravity devices that they've supposedly had. He talks about the Schoberger effect, which was definitely the basis for some of these levitation craft that he talks about. And then the very ending of the story is about this mysterious region called the something hills. I forget what the word was. And he claims that the Nazis were building something down there. So I don't know what all is going on, but I think it's pretty fascinating. And the fact that our present day government seems to have an interest in South America, I mean in Antarctica, and in this ice-free region, certainly suggests that something's going on. Because one thing we do know about these individuals is that the only time they'll spend any money is if it's going to advance their cause. So if they're down there spending a lot of money, then something interesting is happening.
Yeah, they have to determine if they're going to be able to make money down there. there's been some chatter that I've heard that there's another race of beings there. Here you have an underground base there, and it's quite large, and they've been there for quite some time. And I think the Germans knew that many, many years ago when they first went down there, and that's well before World War II began. They scoped that place out and were actually going there throughout the war, as they were to many other places here in the States as well, Montauk being one of them. So the knowledge, the foreknowledge, we'll say, that something was down there was probably something that belonged to the Nazis. And then after Operation Paperclip, I would venture to guess that they took an interest in what was there, the Americans, to find out. They had learned a few things about it. You can't be up there in airplanes starting wars all over the place and not notice some extra traffic. Seth, we seem to have lost our guest again. If you can get him on board. We're waiting for Jim Murray. Strange, strange happenings. Why would they want to stop us from saying this? Now, there were some... There's a variety of websites that have some stories, and they're rather definitive, and then it's not necessarily the case. Okay, do we have Jim back?
Yes, Jim is back. Oh. I was trying to was trying to just listen and catch up. But, yeah, they pulled me off into that vortex again, I'm sorry to say.
Okay, well, basically, I was talking about the fact that the Nazis were likely aware of an alien presence there on Antarctica before World War II, and it was something that they probably looked into after the war. You know, the Northern Arctic expedition transpired over February and March of 1947. So I'm not exactly sure of the dates of the Antarctica expedition. But let's, you know, even if it was around...
It was within a couple of years of that, because that once their interest in the area was established, they gave them the excuse to inaugurate or initiate the International Geophysical Year, and I believe that was in 1950-something.
Yeah.
1952, perhaps, or 55, I don't remember. I remember going through it, because my dad was all excited about it. And I was always hoping something cool would be forthcoming from it. And, of course, a lot of stuff was. But I think whatever they did find, they kept to themselves, as usual, you know. The other thing that's interesting about this whole business of another race or another culture or whatever it is, you know, legends of that ilk have been persisting for a very, very long time. And almost every culture has some reference to it. There's in the Tibetan regions, and in other areas of Asia, they talk about the underworld of Agartha, which can only be reached through certain secret tunnels. And, you know, there's this myth about when the Chinese decided to take over Tibet, and they rampaged all these different lamasteries and monasteries.
Mm-hmm.
That they were actually looking for the entrance to these tunnels. You know, Tibet is such a tiny, inoffensive little country. I always had trouble believing that they usurped it simply for political means. You know, it just didn't make sense to me. But it's not impossible that they were looking for something else. And even in Ireland and other areas, they talk about these beings that come from this underworld. So it's not like it's an isolated legend. And like all legends, it probably has some anchor in reality, even if we don't know exactly what it is.
Yes. Well, now, the trip that he made up to the Arctic, that was really uneventful, wasn't it? But it was this trip that he made to the Antarctic that was rather suspicious, because he came home much sooner than was planned. Do you want
to... Well, the trip that he made to the Arctic was eventful only in the sense that He saw things that he felt didn't belong there.
Mm-hmm.
What the outcome was on the southern trip has never been disclosed to my knowledge. And yeah, he may have come home ahead of schedule, like you say.
Yeah, that's basically what I had heard. Now, I've heard three or four different versions of the story, but some say there was somewhat of a battle, and they met up with some very advanced technologies that they were unaware of, and basically they got their pants kicked and came back. That's one version of it. Now, another one says that they discovered some openings to what led to let's say, an established settlement beneath the surface there. So they had known this for some time. They suspected that the Germans knew it, which was what I was saying when you got knocked off the last time. So I won't mention it again. But
all right.
But they were aware of that, I think. I'm fairly certain. I think they learned that the Nazis really knew what was going on there and possibly got some technology, because that story expands to they were doing some traveling to Mars prior to and during the war. And then we eventually began heading out that way somewhere around the early 1960s. And it wasn't until another 7 or so years when they started mentioning the moon with any great frequency. What's that? Well, Jim got sucked into a hole again. So, right at the point where I was waiting for him to make a comment. Seth, are we trying to get him back? I guess. I got to make sure I know Seth is there. Yep. Okay, he's trying to get him back. Well, I know that there are vortexes over the Midwest. That's for sure.
Don, are you there?
Yes, I am. Right at the point where I'm turning it over to you for you to talk, you disappeared again.
Yeah, somebody definitely does not like the content of this program. That's the most we've ever been interfered with, as far as I know, the whole time we've been on the air together.
Well, so we know that there were craft being developed there, or flown there. The Nazis had flying saucers of different type. Now, they weren't necessarily antimatter type of craft, but they did have some understanding and success in developing anti-gravity devices. But they couldn't go into space with some of these craft that they had, with the gun turrets on the top and what have you. Technology just wasn't complete. But any thoughts on that?
Yes, as a matter of fact, there is. If you look at the work that Schoberger was doing, he was investigating, and always had been investigating, this implosion concept as opposed to explosion concept. And it all has to do with what happens when certain flow characteristics are initiated and supported.
Mm-hmm.
And the diagrams that I have seen of the main propulsion unit in this craft is really, really strange, because there's a thing that looks like a sunburst. Only it's mechanical, but it looks like a sunburst. The wheel has spokes. If you can picture a cone sticking out from something, a long tapered cone, not a short fat one, and mm-hmm. then twisting at the same time, so it's almost like a screw. And there were a whole series of these things which made up this sunburst, and when it's was spun in the proper type of an enclosure, the airflow that resulted was of a hypersonic variety, and it ruptured out on the flanges of this ship in such a way that it caused a lifting thrust as it curved under the ship. It made a giant vortex that just propelled this thing. And The interesting thing about that type of an approach, even though I don't know too much about it, because after all, nobody's seen them. They're all in that secret compartment under the Smithsonian Institute, probably in a big crate. But anyway, they produce this effect by what amounts to a certain series of frequencies of sound, and that can be powered by any kind of engine. It can be electric. It can be gasoline. It can be diesel. I mean, it's pretty interesting because it's not a normal vehicle that would fall into the category of aircraft in the sense that it relies on lift generated by airflow over a wing, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to give Schoberger an awful lot of credit for the things that he knew and developed. It would really be interesting to find out just how far that technology has been pushed in modern times, because the various governments definitely got a hold of it. There's no question about that.
Yeah. Well, we talked about that phenomena when we talked about just the simple circuits that that Tesla had set up and his recognition of dielectricity, which suggests that there's a multidimensional effect that's occurring when you're creating power, or you're manufacturing power, let's say, or producing power, whatever word you want to use to it, to describe it. And that that can exist in and of itself because of other reasons. They don't necessarily have to be phenomena that occur because there's a device that a person developed. Because there could be natural processes going on that would allow that to occur anyway. A pyroelectric effect or a piezoelectric effect that could be seen and measured. We don't always have the reasons why those things occur, but we've given them names and we identify them. Now, when you get into these phenomenon of beings being in the planet, living beings from other parts of the galaxy, and they're trying to keep that a secret. Yeah, your cell phone's going to stop working. You know, my microphone might stop working, you know, because they don't want that truth to come out. It's amazing.
Well, the interesting thing about that is we have to really wonder, if there are these beings down there, they've obviously been here for a while, possibly a long while. What are they here for, you know? It's not like they've announced their presence. So, they've inhabited a rather remote part of our world. It's almost like they really want to remain incognito,
mm-hmm.
but they must be here for a purpose. It would be interesting to know what that is. Have you crossed any paths which give some insights into why they should be here?
Well, I think in some cases they're here because they have nowhere else to go, or at least they came here at some point having fled some dire circumstances. You look at how things are falling apart today, you'd ask the question, what would make them want to come here, the way things are falling apart? But, you know, this is more recent. Maybe they witnessed something, you know, 1,000 times worse where they're from. So they set up shop, did a little bit of hiding, maybe come out at night, you know, when they're not noticed. Picked a good place to be alone, and then You know, I think there are others that are here to plunder, and some want to rule, some want to just control everybody else. That's why you have these different species with different intentions. Their plight was different from where they were. Are you still with us, Jim?
Oh, yeah. I'm just listening and pondering your message. Well, the type that want to control by their very actions, regardless of their technological prowess, it would indicate that they are less evolved morally. You know, but the other ones, which are just hiding out and not bothering anybody, those would be people I'd like to meet. I mean, that sounds like an interesting situation.
Mm-hmm.
The grays and the reptilians and some of these others that are strictly involved in using human race for their own purposes. You know, I would categorize those as evil and possibly even degenerate races.
Mm-hmm.
But somebody that just comes here to salvage their own lives and deliberately picks a place where nobody goes and just quietly goes about their business, that interests me.
Well, I don't think...
If the Germans found them, you know, they did keep pretty interesting records. It would be amazing to find that there was proof of all this somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, part of that, on my part, is intuitive. I'm just telling you what feels like it would have been the situation to me. Why did they take an interest there? Well, they had discovered that there was a presence there, and that it was a desolate place where they could hide, where most people wouldn't want to go. It was, you know, at another corner of the planet, and highly inaccessible for the average person. So it made a perfect hiding place. And it could be that they discovered that on the basis of learning that there was another group that was there. And, you know, when you have to put the history in the proper perspective, because people look at it as these Germans that went crazy and just decided they were going to take over the world. You got to have the perspective of Zionism and what that was. And then you see who the Nazis really were. They weren't Germans gone mad. They were another species masquerading as Germans. See? And today they masquerade as Jewish. But then, during the war, they masqueraded as Germans. They masqueraded as communists. And they really were. But they didn't want us to know that the bankers were the same people as these governments or these political ideologies that became part of the military-industrial complex of Europe. We have the same situation today. They just call it something else. But the idea is to make money by killing people in other countries. And that's called war. And it's... What is really the justification for any war? Somebody went nuts. Somebody's psychopathic at that point and causing others to have to defend themselves. But here today, they just make up stories as to what the cause of the war is, who's behind it, and what really happened, and how we have to put an end to that. You know, which is just nothing but a bunch of lies, because it's all built on this big illusion. Go ahead, Jim. I don't mean to take up all the time.
No. I'm listening carefully to what you're saying because I'm interested in how it might tie into all this, you know. The thing that's kind of interesting, although a little bit elusive, and that is, you know, if the Germans succeeded in interacting with these people at the South Pole, and if they did it before the war, you know, they may not have shown their aggressive side. And it's possible that they struck up some type of a truce or an understanding of sorts with these people. Now, whether or not that resulted in some kind of a technology exchange, of course, I don't know. But it's interesting to speculate on that. And, you know, there's so much evidence that they were developing the most unusual stuff during the war. We didn't realize it until afterwards, you know, when they won the war and started looking at all the stuff that they had in various areas like Tanamundi and some of the industrial complexes that were eventually captured.
Mm-hmm.
But they were almost like, let's put it this way. The stuff was so different from what we were working on that the only excuse that was ever given was that the Germans had isolated themselves, you know, for that 60-year period between before World War I and then all the way into and including World War II, that they, for all intents and purposes, were like isolated from the rest of the world and just following their own paradigm. But what if there was an alien influence? I mean, one of the things they were working on was akin to radar, but it worked with infrared systems, you know, which is certainly doable, but it's just very different from the path that the rest of the world took.
Yeah.
And then we know that they were working on jet engines. We know they were working on super weapons, nuclear weapons, you know, really strange guidance systems that had absolutely nothing to do with the traditional way of approaching that problem. It almost looks as if maybe they had some kind of a secondary input that influenced their direction.
Yeah, I would say they had anti-gravity, and I think they were in the process of developing antimatter, but hadn't gotten there yet. And that's evident in the style of the crafts that they built, because it was almost like looking at a chopper, you know, with a blade going around and gun turrets and stuff like that. Not that you see that all that much on a chopper, but or a cross between a chopper and a fighter jet. That's, you know, a bomber. So I see what we've been taught in history and what's really going on are two different things. You have all this exotic technology that Tesla developed. And the understanding of these natural principles that Victor Schauberger actually alluded to and was involved with in regards to the Austrian government and the forestry department, and then later being quizzed and questioned by the United States. He and his son, so that they could steal all of his ideas and use them for military purposes. And then his demise shortly after returning to Europe. And then the misuse of all this Tesla coil technology that was developed. to get into time traveling and exotic weapons. That's basically what they did with what we had of Tesla's work. So imagine what the Germans did if they were in touch with an alien group. They were getting some top shelf information for the day, anyway. Your comments, Jim?
Yeah, I'm intrigued with that idea, to be honest with you. You know how you're always talking about you intuit various things and you have feelings about stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I have a very strong feeling about this. I don't know exactly what to make of it because it's new. I didn't have it, you know, before being exposed to this information. But it just feels like there's something there.
Mm-hmm.
And the mere fact that our government is down there digging around in the ice seems to suggest something's going on. Now, the only difference is, if there is a colony there of extraterrestrials, I wouldn't be a bit surprised, if they went there, that they wouldn't think twice about killing all these people and just dissecting them and learning how they work internally and then just usurping all their technologies. Because the one thing that really disgusts me about the present power elite, or whatever you want to call them, is they don't have any regard for a darn thing. You know, there's nothing sacred with these people.
Yeah, I'm inclined. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say that really annoys me. I hope that the group that's down there, if in fact they're still alive, has the wherewithal to fight back with something a little bit more advanced than an M16 rifle.
Yeah, I think it is a very advanced group from what I've heard, and that these guys don't really pose any threat to them. They're that advanced, but you still need to recognize the fact that this is going on, and we hear these stories about we're looking for life, we haven't found anything. You know, we did pick up some radio signals. But, you know, when they hear that, they never say, oh, that was just microphone distortion. You know, it's like when they film a craft that's like 10 miles long and 5 miles wide, and there's no doubt about it that they filmed it. It's always, there was a strange anomaly with the camera, and it reflected off of the fender of a car and the fender of the car flashed it off of a window of a big skyscraper. And by the time the camera saw all this, it made it look like a spaceship, you know. So now we have the same phenomenon going on now with microphones. Only it applies to the lies that they say. So the reason I bring that up is we need to look and listen to what they're saying, because a lot of it absolutely doesn't make any sense whatsoever. You get into the discussions about they think they can do something on Mars. You know, and we know that they're up there growing plants on Mars, and that Mars isn't a red planet. It's got lakes, and it's got green plants, and it's got animals, and it's got somewhat of an atmosphere. They know this, and they've been up there for a long time. At least since 1962. So they've been lying to us. Where do they get the money for that? Well, the war on drugs actually is the whole process where they pay for that. And we could go on and on, but it's a black ops program. They're not going to be straightforward and tell us what it's about. But how do you cope with the fact that you might see a craft with the naked eye or looking through a telescope, you might come across a battle going on in space with night vision goggles. Any thoughts on that, Jim?
Well, you know, when I was first exploring possibilities of this type of stuff, was actually under the influence or the direction of Warren Getz up there in northern Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to be honest with you, I saw some very strange things in the sky, and they definitely were not stars. And, you know, we had telescopes set up and whatnot, and we're looking at some of these things. And you can tell the difference between a star and an object if you have just a little bit of visual assistance. So I definitely came to the conclusion that there was stuff going on out there, and that was back in the, I guess that would have been in the late 70s, mid to late 70s. But what we know now, I mean, whatever is going on has definitely escalated. I mean, now we've got little mini wars going on and everything else, and you got this other group that's come in that supposedly on our side. I don't know. It just seems to me that it's amazing that all this stuff can be going on and people down here haven't gotten any real wind of it. It would certainly be interesting if one of the larger crafts got shot down and it actually crashed in a populated area. Now, that would be a tough thing to hush up, irregardless of how many newspapers they own.
Yeah, there were more sightings occurring in different parts of the planet. Recently, actually, it would have been on the 28th of June, there were sightings over the BBC building in London, and those are YouTube videos, actually, that are posted. We know that those craft belong to the United Galactic Federation, and they were making themselves visible. Simple. They weren't attacking anybody. They wanted people to see that they were really there. So,
well, I think it would be really interesting if the United Galactic Federation would just park a portion of their fleet in a synchronous orbit just about 2,000 feet above Washington, D.C., and just sit there for a few days. You know, they don't have to do anything else. That would be a very interesting demonstration.
Well, I think they have done similar things. The problem is that you have those that are obsessed with killing, you see, here. They could make themselves visible. That's not a problem. They've done it on numerous occasions. And why does it have to be Washington?
Well, it doesn't. But, I mean, yeah. I just like the idea of seeing those cockroaches scurry a little bit.
Yeah, you could do it there. Certainly you could do it on Wall Street. Couldn't you?
Yeah, that would be interesting.
But there are a lot of issues because they become the object of interest when they're here because it threatens the whole system. You see, they don't want anybody to know that they really exist. And that's not going to be able to be kept a secret. But they've been planning, you know, dramatic events for so long that to have to deal with somebody showing up and undoing all their plans is unspeakable. You know, they've been preparing for this for thousands of years. And
that's
then
too bad.
the last second. Yeah, too bad is what I say. But
well, you know, something should rain on their parade.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly would like to see it happen.
Yeah. But we do have underground bases all over the country and tunnel systems, and there were underwater bases. We're finding more of them. And there goes Jim again. Well, Seth, I suppose we're going to wrap it up. If you can't get a hold of Jim, don't worry about it, because we're going to say goodnight here. We basically said everything we need to say, but I was going to give Jim the opportunity to make a closing remark, at least. So don't know what's happening. Okay, we have a ring, I'm being told.
Yes, I'm back.
Okay,
you
there.
Know, the insanity of this whole thing is, now that must be about six times tonight that that they pull this stunt. Why don't they just jam the whole show? I mean, it's already obvious what's happening. You know, it's ridiculous. They're only helping to drive our point home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they get a little satisfaction out of it, but, you know, we can pick up the topic on the next show. We do it all the time. Anyway, we're at that point, Jim, where I got to say goodnight to the listening audience and allow you a closing remark or two. And certainly you just made one. That's
well,
right.
Maybe I should change the topic just so that the closing remark doesn't result in another shutdown, you know.
Huh.
Well, let me just say this. This is an area that seems to interest me quite a bit, and I like to do a little bit more digging. I'm going to find a way to get a copy of that 390-page document and see what all's in there. And if something of interest emerges from that effort, I'll be happy to share it.
Okay, well, I look forward to that. Was that all you wanted to say?
Well, anything else, and they're going to shut us down again, you know.
All right, well, Jim, I know we're at not just the end of the show, but we're at the end of the week, and it's a short weekend, but you will be back here on Evident Footprints on the 22nd. Of July. That's next Saturday. So I look forward to your next appearance, and we'll see what we find out about these topics in the interim. Maybe we can revisit some of this stuff.
Sounds good to me, Don. You take care and have a great weekend.
All right. Very good. Folks, that wraps it up. You've been listening to Evident Footprints on bbsradio.com and our guest, Jim Murray. Jim has been a refugee of the show tonight, actually, and he's made it back. So he's like the prodigal son. Want to thank Wind Talkers Radio Network for broadcasting Evident Footprints over at BBS Radio. We had Seth Hendrick on the sound. Special thanks to Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible. And most of all, we thank you, the listening audience, for tuning in. I wish everyone a great weekend. Join me next Monday when my special guest will be Dr. A. Chubot. In the meantime, I wish everyone a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.